Money FM 89.3, best of your money. Money and Me on Your Money, only on Money FM 89.3.
Today, the Dow surpassing 30,000 points. It pulled back from there, of course. But what does that historic cresting of 30,000 really mean, investors, for you? Bitcoin moving past the 19,000 mark. We discuss its long-term prospects. And I beat myself up for not buying Bitcoin when a guest sat across me about years ago, like a decade, and told me to buy it when it was in the hundreds. Also, Goldman and Citi sees gold above 2,000 in 2021. So is the bull market not over? Let's welcome Arun Pai, Chief Strategy Officer at Flow. Good morning, Arun.
Good morning, Michelle. How are you?
Well, it's a pretty sad day for football fans because, you know, we've lost a legend, Maradona. And I don't know if you're a football fan.
I am indeed.
Yeah.
It's really disheartening this year.
Yeah, so young, lost at age 60, passed away from a heart attack. We know also that he struggled with cocaine during his lifetime. But, you know, who can forget the eternal genius, yeah? And the words of Cristiano Ronaldo and what he did with that ball.
Indeed, that the hand of God too, that moment.
Yes, of course. Oh, goodness me. All right, I couldn't start the show without mentioning Maradona because I'm sure a lot of our listeners are going to feel it today and be in mourning as well to some extent. Argentina's declared 3 days of mourning. Okay, Arun, let's talk about 30,000 and the Dow. So people hear that and they think, okay, that's good for history. Is this a welcome party for Biden? What does it really mean for investors? Don't all indexes move up over time?
I mean, that's exactly the point, right? Like, if the underlying constituents of the index keep earning, keep continually increasing their earnings, you will naturally see the index price going up. I mean, just go back like 20-odd years. Who remembers in 1999 Dow Jones crossing 10,000? Or for that matter, in end of 2016, the Dow crossing 20,000. And now in 2020, Dow crosses 30,000, and it's great for Trump to come onto a stage for like all of a minute and, you know, toot his own horn and claim victory over the fact that, you know, he's the one who's ensured that the equity market's right. Mm. But from an investor's perspective, it's literally just that, right? It's just a pure headline number, which from a very long-term perspective of a country that has, you know, its brightest years ahead of it, based on at least what Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, Bezos, Elon Musk, etc. say, one can easily envision a path where in certain number of years, Dow will cross 40,000, 50,000, etc. So I wouldn't be too stuck up on that. I think the interesting thing about what's happening to Dow is, we talked about it like a little, you know, earlier this year, I think around May or June of this year, where we were seeing the constituents of the underlying change. Where, you know, a company like ExxonMobil that's been around for like a century has been removed from this extremely prestigious blue chip stock index and has been replaced by a company like, say, Salesforce. And all of that was on the back of, you know, Apple splitting its shares, leading and Dow being a price weighted index. Suddenly it realized that, oh, wait a minute, technology is a little bit too under-allocated, and hence I need to try and like rejig the constituents. So it was a little bit of a kick in the backside, courtesy of the Apple movement, but it just seems to be like a sign of things to come, right? Where you have the old school companies of oil, asset-heavy, non-renewable side, even if, you know, they're obviously trying to like steer the ship around, but it will take a massive amount of time given the sheer size of their underlying footprint. But I think that's more interesting to see of how the underlying constituents change. And there's this really cool graphic, I guess, that's circulating on LinkedIn about how S&P industries, S&P obviously being, the 500 largest market cap companies in the U.S., and rather than individual company names, it's been categorized by the industry. So, you know, industrials would have been, say, like over 50-60% just as recently as, like, say, 50 years ago. And then healthcare and banks and tech, et cetera. And how that entire percentage of industries that make up the S&P 500 has shifted so dramatically. So I think it's those longer-term trends that investors should pay a lot closer heed to, rather than just these headline numbers of 10,000, 20,000, 30,000, 100,000.
Okay. So, for example, the Dow is made up of the 30 companies. And, you know, to speak about industries, because, you know, the Amazon, Microsoft, Facebook, Apple, Google, the big five, they're not in the Dow. Does this then give us an indication that since the Dow is weighted towards financial stocks and industrial stocks, then the tech-induced rally is broadening?
It's precise. Like, the Dow is, I think it was a potentially a lot more powerful back in the day, and it still is to a very large extent. The S&P 500 that clearly dictates the 500 largest companies, I think, is a more more relevant index to investors. And you're spot on. Like, the only of all these large tech companies, only Apple was there within the Dow, right? Like, Google is not there, Amazon is not there, which is quite surprising. And that's just the way, the nature of how Dow Jones structures its index. So it's not a true representation of the largest market cap companies or anything of that effect on the index. It's more based on price weight. And then the fact that, you know, Google and Amazon's share prices are so much higher, it causes a bit of an issue to put, to be put into this price-weighted index. But your point is absolutely spot on. It's all about trying to identify. Maybe, you know, like, investing into the Dow versus investing into the S&P, I personally feel investing into the S&P 500 gives you a wider, more diversified, and you're literally picking the winners, right? Because it is the 500 largest market cap companies. It's not, the index constituents are not just created by a bunch of people in a closed door room.
Okay, I'm just going to play devil's advocate because I, you know, have to as a journalist.
Please.
If you invested in the Dow versus S&P 500, wouldn't that be a better bet at this time when there's so much optimism over vaccines that the stocks that can keep climbing are going to be the financials and the industrials?
So that's an excellent question. In terms of an investment hypothesis, when I meant invest into the S&P 500, it was nothing to do with, like, right here, right now. Like, nothing in terms of post-COVID or pre-COVID. It was just purely to give investors, if they're looking for a very widely diversified stake in the U.S. economy, and they believe that the U.S. economy will do very well, that is the index to go for, not so much the Dow. Coming to the point of, is the S&P 500 heavily weighted towards tech? 100% right. From the perspective of, is it potentially more in the overvalued segment of things, given how much the tech stocks have run up? Again, a gazillion percent right. So from that perspective, there are a lot more value plays, I would say, within the Dow Jones index vis-a-vis the S&P.
Okay. The Wall Street Journal says, if you look at what's moved the Dow, this is a self-perpetuating upward spiral. And that the low interest rates and the buy the dip mantra and the Joe Biden optimism that's led to this ascending pattern. So, you know, because I know analysts out there who almost stake their reputations on being able to sort of predict where the Dow is going. And they're now saying, you know, the Dow is going to hit 33,000. That's the next important psychological mark. What do you make of that?
I mean, honestly, any financial analyst who comes out trying to predict exactly what number a certain index is going to be has pretty much always been proven wrong. And you can take, like, various time spans. You can take all sorts of, you know, over the course. I'm sure, you know, like, I can come on to one show and I will say, yeah, Dow is going to be at 33,000. I can go to the other show and say Dow is going to be, like, lower next year. One show will pick it up and say, oh, you know what, this is correct. So it really doesn't pay value to that. What I think, though, is the underlying, and the flip side, though, is people don't want to hear just, like, text, right? They want to hear numbers.
Okay,
where do you think the number is going to be in 1 year's time? And the honest answer is no one has a clue.
Okay.
If the world's most famous and best investor over the course of the last 50, 60 years, Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger, have never, ever proclaimed that they're able to foresee where a certain index price will be or a certain stock price will be over the next 6 months or 1 year, then it's kind of like a fool's errand to be trying. The flip side, though, is from the perspective of why the analyst feels that the Dow will go up. Hmm. It could be 33,000, it could be 31,000, it could be 40,000, right? From that perspective, what is the underlying rationale? And does it make sense from a risk-reward perspective to be scaling into that investment right now? Low interest rate, 100% right. You know, money is being printed. The Fed, it's going to let inflation overshoot more than 2%, which is causing a lot of, you know, mess in the financial markets in the other extreme on one side. But in terms of the massive prop up of asset values or equity value, it definitely is one of the largest driving factors behind that. And knowing fully well what Powell has come out saying, that there is not going to be a big change, though yesterday they were saying that they're going to start tapering asset purchases. From the perspective of at least the short-term interest rate, that's not going high anytime soon. And he still is claiming that. That will definitely provide a tailwind to equity prices.
All right. Well, thanks for clarifying that for us. Let's turn our attention to Bitcoin. I don't know if you've scaled into Bitcoin. All this time we've talked, have I asked you, do you own Bitcoins?
You have, and sadly, I am not a big proponent. Oh, well, it is what it is. And that's the beauty of the financial markets, right?
Okay, I think I've only spoken to one person who actually owns 3 Bitcoins, one for each of his children. Now, the price of Bitcoin has broken through 19,000 for the first time in almost 3 years, which means the world's biggest cryptocurrency is close to its all-time high of just under 20,000. So Bitcoin has surged by almost 40% in November, up about 160% this year. It reached a peak of just under 20,000 back in December 2017. Don't forget, it crashed spectacularly then, all right? It lost a quarter of its value in a single day back then. So investors and analysts say that the COVID pandemic has led to this reassessment of Bitcoin's value as an alternative currency, perhaps even as an alternative to gold. So even as we discuss Bitcoin's long-term prospects, listeners, please keep in mind that cryptocurrencies are notoriously volatile, and other digital currencies, Ethereum, Litecoin, XRP, they've also regained popularity in recent months. So here's a question I keep browbeating Arun with. Where is Bitcoin going?
Your guess, honestly, is as good as mine, as is pretty much everyone else's in this world, to be honest, at this point. But again, coming to the underlying factors, right? Maybe I'll try and split it up into two parts. One is the more longer-term 20,000 feet in the air analysis, and one is the more on the ground, what's been happening over the past couple of weeks or a month.
Okay.
Let's start with the top-down 20,000 feet in the air approach. Extremely low interest rates. So you're taking your hard-earned cash savings, putting it into a bank, earning 0%, leads people to speculate. There's no other ways to look at it, right? It could be in equity. Back in 2006, it was in plonking down money into buying houses, you name it, across the spectrum. In this specific case, it seems like Bitcoin has caught a decent amount of that money. Slightly more longer-term trends of people being very afraid of the amount of US dollars that are being printed by the government, which is leading to people questioning, is USD going to be the reserve currency of the world? Maybe, maybe not. Maybe I need to start diversifying my underlying currency, quote-unquote, exposure if people are envisioning Bitcoin to be as a currency. Thirdly, the inflation aspect, right, where, sure, the Fed has said, even if inflation spikes higher, we're not going to increase interest rates. Where do you deploy your capital to potentially be hedged against that? And it's funny how when a certain sect of investors or potentially punters or traders see a certain underlying having performed well in the recent past, they start assuming or thinking that people get into this herd mentality, right? Where, oh, it's done so well in the past 3 months, let me scale up. Mm. And it's interesting that you brought up this point about Bitcoin, because you also rightfully mentioned, let's take a step back. Just a couple of years ago, it was also at like close to 19,000. And then it went down to 3,000, right? Mm. It lost like 3/4 of its value. So from that perspective, you know, gold inflation hedge, maybe, maybe not, but at least it has 200, 300 years of data backing it up. But those are the couple of like, you know, 20,000 feet in the air rationales of why people are thinking of going into Bitcoin. Now come to the present day scenario. A really vocal VC turned investor, Shamath, he came out saying, you know what? Everyone, every citizen should hold at least 1% of their assets in Bitcoin. And it's something that's quite, you know, simple and easy to say. And people listen to it and they're like, oh, it's only 1%, right? And it could either go up or down like 10 times, 20 times. Why don't I do this? And then the second you start getting millions of people taking 1% of their hard-earned assets and putting it into a certain underlying instrument, you will naturally see the share price go up quite a bit. I personally am a little bit uncertain about something like that because, you know, just because it's 1% of your assets and you think of it as a hedge, that works only if you think that my neighbors will also be doing the exact same thing. And that kind of turns out into a Ponzi scheme, right? Where a lot of people lost a lot of their savings going into the tulip mania, going into the dot-com stocks back in 1999. Anything that's a massive bubble leads people to start scaling up with 1%, then increasing that to 5%, then seeing if it's 30, 50%, and then sadly, potentially losing half of their hard-earned wealth.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that we're seeing very recently, PayPal and Square, two, you know, massive fintech companies, there are rumors that they, because they are now supporting Bitcoin buying within their ecosystems, to facilitate that, they are buying anywhere from 70% to 100% of the new supply that's coming into the market.
Mm.
And that's how Bitcoin gets created, right? Like every time someone solves a mathematical equation, certain more number of Bitcoins are released into the market. And obviously, like solving these mathematical problems becomes more and more difficult. It requires more and more computing power, which requires more and more energy. So from the perspective of the new supply that's coming into the market, which will always happen until a certain, I think, I don't know how many years into the future it is, where the supply gets capped out, PayPal and Square are literally buying up everything there is. I think my personal perspective is the underlying, and this hasn't changed, be it if it's a 19,000, 50,000, or it goes down to 1,000. I think the underlying technology is quite interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And from the aspect of using it in blockchain enterprise software to make things a little bit more ironclad, especially be it in the financial segment in terms of letters of credit, or for that matter of transportation of, say, diamonds or agricultural goods to know exactly where the transition of which underlying took place. From that perspective, you know, I think it's a fantastic underlying. From the perspective of Bitcoin or other or Ether or any other aspect of using it as an investment for speculation or for any other purpose, I would truly like to see whether it actually does become mainstream or not.
Mm.
And this is something, you know, the BlackRock chief investment officer came out saying the same thing. That's the big question mark for me. And until that point of time, I just don't see it as a store, as a value store, nor as an investment that gives me predictable returns, be it in the form of a dividend or cash flow. Hence, I will stay away from it.
Until the digital asset becomes mainstream and sort of everybody, your grandmother has it in her wallet, that kind of thing.
Like if you, a grandmother is stretching it, to be honest, but even if I have it, let's start with baby steps, right, Michelle? Like even if I am willing to have a certain amount of Bitcoin, knowing fully well that I can go to like, say, a Starbucks or go to a merchant and buy a certain good using that in a seamless manner, the way I do with my cash or credit cards right now, in Singapore dollars or when I'm traveling in a certain other currency. Until that point of time, it's a huge question mark. And I think the biggest question mark to this is the regulatory clampdown that can easily occur on this. Because, I mean, China is coming up with its own digital coin. The US has already shut down Facebook because they've realized that they will just have too much power. Already, social media companies have way too much power in terms of enabling one person sitting in one corner of the earth to, you know, magnify his or her message to the entire world population. So leave aside the fact that you can now bring the financial aspect of that into play. I just don't envision how central banks of the world are going to allow this to happen. So from that perspective, I think Bitcoin can be very risky, to be honest.
Yeah, thanks for that. I mean, I hadn't read that. PayPal and Square scooping up 100% of newly mined Bitcoins. You have to keep that in mind if you're assessing the rally. All right. You're right.
No, absolutely.
Yeah, great piece there. All right, let's talk about gold. Because, you know, people think, oh, is Bitcoin an alternative to gold? Well, let's see how gold is doing. Goldman says it sees gold cresting 2,000 in 2021. According to analysts at Citi as well, despite the upturn in the global economic outlook, gold's bullish cycle, they expect to continue. What do you think?
I mean, again, I think the 20,000 feet in the air analysis of Bitcoin plays very well for gold, with the additional aspect of the fact that it has a 200-year track record going for it, right? Where it actually has played out to be an inflation hedge for a really long period of time. Still, is the concept that, you know, it's a gold bar or a digital certificate just sitting over there, and the only way the share price of that will increase or the value of that will increase is if someone else is willing to buy it from you at a higher price. It's not earning any dividends. It's not a productive asset by any stretch of the means, like, say, a farm or something else. It's this, you know, bright gold, yellow, or, you know, in reality, a very dull yellow piece of metal that just sits in a corner, and people around it are exchanging it at higher prices. But from the perspective of having a 200-year track record and it working out as a very good inflation hedge, I can definitely see why the likes of Goldman as well as Citibank are claiming that, you know, the underlying price of gold should be appreciating in the future. All of this boils down to, you know, what the Fed is doing, and the Fed being the largest central bank will force other central banks to follow suit. So it all stems from that. And a lot of things can go well and a lot of things can go poorly on the back of that. And we've seen pockets of, you know, massive bubbles getting created, you know, anywhere from like the last 250 years. And I'm sure we'll continue to see it in the next 250 years. That's just the nature of financial markets. So gold specifically, again, low interest rate, money's being printed, potential inflation hedge, are all aspects that provide a tailwind to the underlying metal.
Fantastic. Right. We've learned so much today. Arun, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, as always, for having me, Michelle.
Sheer genius there. Arun Pai, Chief Strategy Officer at Flow, helping us understand what markets are talking about today. I'm Michelle Martin.
Before acting on the information on Money FM, please consider if it's suitable for your own investment objectives, financial situation, and risk tolerance. To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg or download the SPH radio app available on Google Play or the App Store.